loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, Donald Trump has withdrawn from the Iran nuclear deal. He did that this afternoon. He also used the most bellicose and belligerent language to threaten Iran, to suggest a military confrontation with Iran is coming. And he also announced the imposition of new, what he called the toughest economic sanctions against Iran ever. And then our regular Tuesday segment on the economy and economic issues. This segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism, takes place every Tuesday with Daniel Sankey. Today we talk about what unemployment numbers really mean and how the price of oil is affecting geopolitics.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Senate candidate and former mining company CEO Don Blankenship, who spent a year in prison for his role in the deaths of 29 miners, appears to be surging in the West Virginia Senate race in light of an overtly racist and xenophobic television ad his campaign has been airing this week. Blankenship says that if elected, he will create jobs for Americans, not for, quote, China people, unquote, and he excoriates Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, whose wife is Chinese-American, as, quote, cocaine Mitch. Next, Oliver North, the central figure in the Iran-Contra scandal of the 1980s and now a Fox News contributor, was named president of the National Rifle Association yesterday. It was North who illegally arranged for arms sales to Iran during the Iran-Iraq War and then used the proceeds to illegally purchase weapons for the Contra rebels, who were fighting to overthrow the Nicaraguan government. Then peace and anti-torture groups have begun arriving on Capitol Hill to protest the nomination of Gina Haspel to be CIA director. Haspel was integral to the CIA's torture program during the George W. Bush administration. She headed a secret prison, oversaw torture sessions, and later destroyed videotaped evidence of the torture. And then a new report in the Observer newspaper and New Yorker magazine says that unidentified people connected to the Trump administration hired a private Israeli intelligence company last year to dig up embarrassing information, primarily sexual in nature, on Democrats who had supported the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, all in an effort to discredit it. This Israeli firm is the same one allegedly hired by movie mogul Harvey Weinstein to discredit women who accused him of sexual improprieties. And finally, President Trump is sending a plan to Congress that calls for cutting $15 billion in previously approved spending. Almost half the cuts would come from two accounts within the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, while another $800 million would come from within the Obamacare program. And in other headlines, Kim Jong-un is in China today visiting Xi Jinping to talk about the upcoming summit with the United States. This is the second day of a two-day visit by Kim. In a speech today about the Iran deal, President Trump also confirmed that there is a time and a place confirmed for his own meeting with Kim. Argentina started talks with the International Monetary Fund today as a measure to save its failing economy despite the IMF's difficult history in Latin America and strict conditions. There's a new outbreak of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo just announced today. Over the past 5 weeks, there have been 21 apparent cases with 17 deaths. Lab results have come back confirming Ebola in at least two of those cases so far. The last outbreak was in 2017 and was quickly contained. In a bad sign for Theresa May, Britain's upper house of parliament voted against leaving the European Union's single market. The Brexit plans have been complicated and rocky as they head through the legislature. Those are today's headlines. Next up is a discussion of President Trump leaving the Iran nuclear deal. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
In dramatic fashion, Donald Trump took to the airwaves to announce that the United States was leaving the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran nuclear arms deal. Trump has been signaling his decision for many months. The speech was filled with bellicose and threatening language. What comes next? Is the Trump administration gearing up for military conflict and another war in Syria? We're joined in studio by Gareth Porter. Gareth is a historian, investigative journalist, and analyst specializing in U.S. national security policy and the author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran nuclear scare. Gareth Porter, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thanks so much for having me back, Brian.
Not surprising today, but the stage is set now for, well, you tell us what comes next.
Well, I definitely think that the danger of war has suddenly increased because of the announcement by Donald Trump. And the plan that they have at this moment is certainly uncertain. Whether they do have a plan is doubtful. And what we do know is that he is working on a game plan that was closely scripted in conjunction with, if not written by, Benjamin Netanyahu himself. It sounded certainly in the early part of the speech as though it was something that had been scripted by Netanyahu, because he gave unqualified applause to what Netanyahu did last week in his bizarre, from my point of view, presentation of the idea that they had some that Israeli commandos had captured half a ton of secret military documents on a covert nuclear weapons research program that were hidden in plain sight in Tehran without any security whatsoever, and then went on to talk about documents which I have written about extensively, as you, I'm sure you know, and can show were fabrications by Israel's Mossad intelligence agency. So that was not a good start. But I think what we saw here is the Trump response to his political base, based on the promise that he made that he would tear up the JCPOA, and his conviction that this was a bad deal. And I think that takes us into uncharted territory, which is particularly frightening for two reasons. One, he has an advisor, not John Bolton, who has a history, personal history, of having been deeply involved in Dick Cheney's plot, I think it's fair to call it, in 2003 to 2007, to basically eliminate the political obstacles to the use of military force by the United States against Iran, a plan which he did try to carry out in 2007. And Bolton did, in fact, actively carry out a plan to help him in that regard in 2004-2005. So Bolton, you know, is a well-known, not just a hawk, but somebody who has, in fact, participated in a previous plan to bomb Iran, and obviously has not changed his mind at all, and will continue to urge that kind of a plan on Trump, who seems to be quite open to it.
Yeah, I'm glad you said it's not just a hawk. I mean, hawks are getting a bad name these days. Beautiful bird. I mean, the reality is hawks don't go and drop bombs and missiles on other people, but people like John Bolton do, and certainly Donald Trump may be setting the stage for it. We're going to hear an audio clip from today's amazingly bellicose speech from Trump. And it cites, Gareth, just what you're talking about. That cartoonish presentation by Benjamin Netanyahu is now, according to the President of the United States, the proof that Iran actually, in defiance of all other estimates and assessments from international inspectors, that it has a secret nuclear weapons program. Let's listen to Donald Trump from today.
Today, we have definitive proof that this Iranian promise was a lie. Last week, Israel published intelligence documents, long concealed by Iran, conclusively showing the Iranian regime and its history of pursuing nuclear weapons.
So, John Kiriakou, I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu gets up with those like ridiculous cartoonish figures, sort of like for like a third grade, you know, front of the class presentation. Now Donald Trump says, we now have definite evidence.
Yeah, this was Benjamin Netanyahu's script. And it's a script that was closely followed by the White House's National Security Council. The fix was in. You know, so many of us talked all week last week about the possibility of remaining in the JCPOA, perhaps trying to alter it or to renegotiate portions of it. That was never the plan in retrospect. The plan was to kill it.
Yeah. And then again, you know, right as Trump was speaking, the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, announced, this was at the same moment, that they were ordering their troops on high alert because of so-called Iranian activity inside of Syria. Then the Israeli government ordered local governments in the northern part of Israel to open up bomb shelters for people up around the Golan Heights area. And at the same time, and I started tweeting and on my own Twitter, beware of a provocation because if Israel at this moment strikes Iranian forces inside of Syria, then, you know, Iran might retaliate. And if they retaliate, then, you know, the stage has been set for confrontation. I mean, we have breaking news right now.
Yeah,
John,
there's breaking news right now as we're speaking from the Associated Press. There's no background information to it. It's just a headline so far saying Syrian TV reports Israeli airstrikes near the capital Damascus, says air defenses shot down two missiles. So the attack has begun.
This is coordinated, Gareth. I mean, you have Israel, you have the Trump administration. The Saudis have also announced that they're all with this. We're going somewhere else right now.
Well, I would actually go further than what you've just suggested, which is certainly accurate, and point out that last December, there was a reported meeting, and it was reported by the Israeli press, by a journalist who is not a fringe element in the Israeli press world, that there was a meeting between top officials of the Trump administration and officials of the Netanyahu government to map out a common strategy towards Iran, which would include several elements that certainly comprehended the question of what to do about the Iran nuclear deal, but also, of course, was going to deal with what was going on in Syria. And the Israeli, obviously we know now, much better than we did then, the Israeli plan to take the offensive in a very aggressive way through bombing of sites which the Iranian forces have been using, which are Syrian government bases in Syria, far from the Israeli border. They're not even anywhere close to the Golan Heights border with Israel. So what this shows me is that this combination of the Israeli offensive in Syria and the Netanyahu presentation of this phony documentation, which again, as I pointed out, is an emanation of a highly successful disinformation campaign that goes back to the period of 2003-2004 and has continued to be effective ever since then. All that and the Trump administration policy announcement now about leaving the JCPOA on May 12th. All this, I believe, it's fair to say, was scripted ahead of time between the United States and Israel.
Yeah, Trump called Iran, when he opened, the Iranian regime is the leading state sponsor of terror. Just on the facts. I mean, they don't have to say what the facts are. It's just like, if you challenge U.S. hegemony in Syria, or if you support the Palestinian people, or if you don't just get on your knees, then you're the leading state sponsor of terror. But this kind of language, given the fact that the Obama administration had enlisted the support of all five members of the Security Council plus Germany and engaged in years of negotiations and come up with a regime for inspections that Iran allowed the tightest, most comprehensive, most intrusive weapons inspection or nuclear inspection regime of any country. And then this is the language of the president of the United States, who says the whole thing is a lie.
And he doesn't even get his facts right, even in that second sentence of the speech, saying that Iran supports terrorist proxies and militias such as Hezbollah, Hamas, Taliban, and Al-Qaeda. Well, there's never been any intelligence that Iran supported the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. That's just made up. And indeed, the Taliban had executed Iranian diplomats in Kabul when they were still in power. The Taliban had notoriously terrible relations with the Iranians. So to say that the Iranians support the Taliban and Al-Qaeda is just simply not true.
Well, I would suggest a slight emendation of that statement, which is that it's perfectly credible to me, perfectly reasonable to believe that the Iranians have made contact with the Taliban leadership, as has the United States in the past, to actually help to fight against ISIS, which has established bases Afghanistan. And if there were a rational policy in the United States, we'd be doing the same thing. Who knows? Maybe we tried to do it. I don't know, but I doubt it. But I think that probably accounts for at least the majority of the reports that have come in about Iran and the Taliban.
That's the voice of Gareth Porter. Gareth is a journalist, a historian. He is the author of Manufactured Crisis, the untold story of the Iran nuclear scare. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. We're talking about the fact that Donald Trump today announced that the United States was leaving the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear arms deal, that it would impose the newest or the toughest sanctions ever, as Trump said, on Iran, again, in complete non-compliance with what the United States agreed to. He also threatened any other country that did business with Iran on the pretext that any business with Iran was just doing business to support Iran's nuclear or terrorist actions, meaning he's saying basically, it seems to me, Gareth, to Britain, to France, Macron was here. He obviously favored keeping in the deal, and the Iranians are still talking to them. But you have France, you have Britain, you have Germany, and Trump is saying to them, guess what, guys? You want the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Make a decision. You want to trade with Iran? You want to do business with Iran's banks, or would you prefer to do business with the United States of America and with Wall Street?
That's exactly right. I mean, this has been a primary tool of pressure by the Trump administration on the Europeans. And I have to say, this was also the case during the Obama administration. This is not something that is completely new, but I think Trump has put even more emphasis now on this for obvious reasons. But, you know, the Europeans resent this. We've talked about this before on your show, and we know that all three European allies of the United States are resentful about this, and they believe that it is completely unfair practice by the United States. The United States is the only one who practices extraterritorial sanctions in the world, and this is one of those issues that is peculiar, shall we say, to American hegemony in world politics, and has generated a lot of opposition. But I think that this is going to be particularly problematic in the coming months. I don't think there's really any chance that there can be a successful long-term or even medium-term JCPOA that just involves the Europeans and Iran, because the Iranians cannot get the kind of economic benefits under the agreement that they were promised because of the pressure put on the Europeans by U.S. economic institutions, essentially, the Treasury Department and U.S. economic institutions. So I think that's really another way in which we find ourselves heading in what I call uncharted territory. And the other point that I should have made when I talked about that the previous time is that it's uncharted territory in part because now there is no diplomatic option. It's been completely destroyed. He can't turn around. He's not going to turn around and say, okay, I was wrong. Now we're going to try diplomacy again. And there's no reason why the Iranians would credit any such statement anyway. So what does that leave us except for pressure through economic sanctions and ultimately the option of military force? So, you know, this is a very, very dark situation that I think we're
dark
facing.
And we've tried to avoid hyperbolic statements, but I too believe we're at the edge of the cliff here in terms of confrontation. And again, for our audience, you're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're in studio with co-host John Kiriakou. Gareth Porter is our guest. At this moment, right after Trump spoke, explosions heard in Damascus, Israeli bombs or missiles being dropped on Syria or Iranian forces in Syria right at this moment. Again, I want to go and listen to another audio clip from Trump's speech. This is kind of how he ended it. And it suggests, I think, where we're heading right now, which is crazy. And again, for our audience, Iran has 80 million people. It has a big military. It has an advanced military capability. We're talking about not simply like a small conflict, but a potential regional conflict. And again, without having to sound hyperbolic, Regional conflicts have a tendency to draw in other major players. I mean, this is serious, serious stuff. Let's listen to Donald Trump.
If the regime continues its nuclear aspirations, it will have bigger problems than it has ever had before.
Okay, well, what is that? the U.S. government overthrew the democratically elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953. That was a big problem. The U.S. imposed the Shah of Iran on the people of Iran for 26 years. That was a big problem. The U.S. has imposed severe economic sanctions on Iran for decades now. That was a big problem. So what's the bigger problem?
Well, I think, you know, clearly he is prefiguring a new emphasis in U.S. policy on regime change. And he hinted at that very broadly in the speech. There was language which addressed the Iranian people and suggested that, they were tired of this regime and it was time for them to have something different, although those were not the exact words. And bear in mind that, again, his national security advisor, John Bolton, was part of the contingent within the George W. Bush administration, which was clearly aiming at regime change. This was not just rhetoric. This was, in fact, the objective that the group of neoconservatives around Dick Cheney in the vice president's office, but also including John Bolton and Douglas Feith at the Pentagon, this was the explicit objective that they were pursuing. And the idea was that they believed that there would be an uprising of some sort at some point in the near future, and that then it would be time for the United States to support that with military force. When that didn't happen, and the United States got bogged down in Iraq, the plan changed, and instead they went for the scenario of taking advantage of an alleged Iranian provocation, supplying the projectiles to the Shiite forces in Iraq who were fighting the Americans and caused multiple deaths. But again, the Pentagon said no to it, and that is what I think would happen again. But we now do not have a George W. Bush in 2007 who no longer listened to the vice president, Dick Cheney, because he had steered him into such a horribly mistaken war in Iraq. And therefore, I think, again, this is another aspect of this picture which looks extremely dire.
We clearly did not learn a lesson from the Iraq War, where the administration of George W. Bush, with these people that Gareth just talked about, Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and Doug Feith, etc., they created a policy, and then they either tailored or created their own intelligence to fit the policy. And so we're seeing a repeat of that history right now, where you've got the JCPOA. It's been in place for quite some time now. It was actually working. As Brian pointed out, it was an intrusive inspection regime and the Iranians agreed to it. And now there is no inspection regime. And now there's no leverage that the United States and its allies have over the Iranian government to dissuade them or discourage them from creating a nuclear weapons program.
Before Gareth responds, because this is exactly along the lines of what you're talking about, John. Here's from the Washington Post reporting on the Iranian reaction to Trump. President Hassan Rouhani, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, has said that he directed his diplomats to negotiate with European countries, Russia and China, about remaining in the nuclear deal despite U.S. withdrawal from the agreement. But Rouhani said Iran is ready to start unlimited uranium enrichment if these negotiations do not yield benefits in a couple of weeks. So we're in a very, very tight timetable here.
I want to respond to what John said, because it's such a key point. That what Trump is doing here is essentially provoking Iran. It's essentially unnecessarily provoking a situation where the kind of Bolton option, a military option, if you will, becomes then really the obvious choice. And it reflects precisely the kind of strategic thinking, if you will, that was found in the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, with Cheney and Bolton and the others, because they did not want to have any positive outcome They wanted the outcome to be as negative as possible. They wanted nothing in the international politics surrounding the Iran nuclear issue that would interfere with the military option. And so that suggests that whether Trump has consciously already chosen that or whether he's being maneuvered by Netanyahu and Bolton, we do in fact find ourselves in a situation where that is the direction that things are moving. And I hate to be a Cassandra, but I have to say that I do believe that there's a trajectory here that reflects not just Trump's own personal predilections and John Bolton's predilections, but a much longer history in which the U.S. National security structure has chosen to create its own facts. So this is what you were talking about, Brian. They've created their own facts, which are convenient to their bureaucratic and personal interests. And now we are finding ourselves facing a very steep price for that predilection for creating facts regardless of the truth. Facts in quotation marks, which are contradicted clearly by the reality.
Congress voted 419-3 to impose new sanctions on Iran, North Korea, and Russia. The Senate voted 98-2 for those sanctions. Then Trump signed them into law. Those sanctions themselves were a violation, really, of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. I agree with you, Gareth. I think if there's actually a military showdown or a conflict between the United States government and the Israeli government and Iranian forces, the Democrats, they're not going to be supporting anything other than their government, which would be the Trump administration. 1 minute left.
Absolutely. That is a point that I have considered already and find extremely important. And in fact, when I write about this next, I will point out that a couple of figures who were involved in the JCPOA, either directly or indirectly, have already begun to shift their position to say, yes, Netanyahu was right, the Iranians were lying, and we need to put pressure on the Iranians to come clean. It's the same kind of stuff that we heard during the Obama administration. And so I think the logic of this is precisely what you've said, that the Democrats will fall into line behind Trump in this regard.
Yeah, good point. I mean, when Ronald Reagan was elected, I thought he was a right-wing lunatic and everyone would reject him because he was so frightening, but because he became the consensus candidate, really, of the ruling summit in America. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined in studio by Gareth Porter. Gareth is a historian, investigative journalist, and analyst specializing in U.S. national security policy. He is the author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Stay with us after a short break. We'll be right back.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series, it's every Tuesday, entitled False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with financial policy analyst Daniel Sankey. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So much is happening, but guess what? So much happens every week and every day. I mean, if you think about what politics is in many ways an expression of economics or concentrated economics. And so a lot of what happens in the political world that appears to be political, underneath it or behind it, driving it, are actually economic interests and or certainly political interests who are taking advantage or making hay out of economic events that they have nothing to do with. That's certainly true, Daniel Sankey, when it comes to the unemployment rate, which has officially dropped below 4% for the first time in a long time. And of course, Donald Trump says, I've made America great again. It's working. And of course, because of the way politics works, to some extent, a Trump or whoever is the person in office, if there is an economic expansion of any type, they're able to take credit for it. It helps them. But let's talk about whether Donald Trump, in fact, has anything to do with the still minor drop in the unemployment rate.
Yeah, I think this is really important to discuss because politicians love to use these numbers and these reports to really pad their administrations and to show that, you know, they're doing good things for working Americans. I think the reason why it's so important to talk about this is I really want to talk about and kind of unpack how we calculate that unemployment rate. Where does it come from? How do we figure it out? You know, Reuters at least is honest in that, you know, and I'm quoting it, that the unemployment rate dropped to less than 4%. It's been about almost 18 years since this happened. But the reason is that some out-of-work Americans have, quotes, left the labor force. So that is to say, people that have been looking for work for an extended period of time cannot obtain work and have effectively given up. And these people are no longer calculated in the unemployment rate. They're simply dropped out. And this has helped lower the unemployment rate because we're not counting a certain amount of unemployed people, essentially. You know, so this is incredibly dishonest. I think that there's a lot of other ways they kind of massage those numbers. If I get paid $10 by my neighbor to mow his lawn, I'm considered employed. That by these definitions, I'm employed. I have a job. So if I'm working part-time 20 hours a week at Starbucks with no benefits, trying to pay rent, which is an impossibility, I'm considered employed. Really what matters and the numbers that matters are wage growth and job stability. Because what we've seen is incredibly stagnant wage growth and this new advent of really precarious jobs that are equivalent to sort of contract work, whether we're talking about, you know, the gig economy like Uber or something like that. And people are aware of this. So this desperation from this lack of real jobs, jobs that are substantial, that pay a living wage, that provide benefits, was really in a large way what rocketed Trump to victory. Because what he was willing to do on the campaign trail was talk about jobs, jobs, jobs over and over again, and what he was going to do to get people jobs. He went to the Rust Belt. He went to all these communities that had been really decimated and told them, you know, what they needed, what they wanted to hear, which was that they were going to get this economic boost. And people, you know, continue to be, you know, desperate in this environment. So, you know, people that are employed, quote unquote, mowing their neighbor's lawn for $10 a week or something like that, that's not real employment. And these numbers acting like somehow the economy has shifted in some fundamental way, that we're roaring and chugging along, that people have real jobs and employment, is a really dishonest interpretation of the numbers. And I think really how the federal government chooses to calculate these numbers is extremely dishonest, because it does not accurately reflect what's really going on in working class people's lives. We just see this headline that shows a percentage, and it's really not broken down or taken apart in a meaningful way.
You know, I'm looking at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. This is the federal government, and they kind of help the public understand. It really helped confuse the public. They say it's to help the public understand what it means to be employed or unemployed and how that gets counted. And here's what they say. People with jobs are employed. One. Two. People who are jobless, looking for a job, and available for work are unemployed. So therein, if you're jobless and you're available for work, you're unemployed. If you're looking for a job, you're unemployed. But if you've given up looking for a job because you just can't get one, you're not unemployed. So they don't sort of break that out, as you were saying, Daniel. Three, this is their words. The labor force is made up of the employed and the unemployed. People who are neither employed nor unemployed are not in the labor force. Now, there you have it. I mean, if you're not employed and you're not unemployed,
it's ridiculous.
You're unemployed.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what
right.
You are.
That's it. And you know what? I'll say something, too. I was self-employed in 2011, making a handsome living, and suddenly I was unemployed. But because I had been self-employed, my unemployment didn't count. Not only did it not count, but I wasn't eligible for any kind of unemployment benefits.
Yeah, exactly.
And there are lots of Americans in that same
and
kind
that's
of position.
Enough, that's, oh yeah, that's a whole other issue. The issue of who actually gets unemployment insurance, and if people haven't been unemployed, they might not know. You get 50% of your gross income. So let's say I'm making $500 a week. Now I'll get $250 a week for 6 months.
Right.
And after 6 months,
you're done. Your own.
You're on your own. And also, because of Ronald Reagan, the Reagan Revolution, that $250 is now taxable income. Mm-hmm. It used to be, before Reagan, That was not considered taxable income.
Right.
Because guess what? The unemployment insurance is something we've already paid for when we were employed.
That's right.
The
employers we've already paid
pay
the tax.
A part of it, and we pay an equal amount. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, and that's a really important point, is this unemployment insurance doesn't just come out of thin air. We pay for it. It's our money that's given into it. So why on earth should we feel bad about using it or feel like we're somehow entitled to it? We paid for it. You know, when you talk about the unemployed and unemployment numbers, really that's just neoclassical economics, which is a mainstream form of economics. The vast majority of people on Wall Street subscribe to it. Vast majority of people in Washington subscribe to it. And it's this ridiculous notion that all unemployment is voluntary, that people choose to not be unemployed, right? And that's a decision they've made. And people do this calculation where they say, well, I want some leisure time, but I also want to work. So I'm going to work less, or I'm going to work not as much or whatever, because I'm doing this kind of calculus between my free time and my desire for a living wage. You know, it's ridiculous. Anybody who can sit there and honestly say that employment or unemployment is chosen, you know, is absurd. In the Bay Area, you know, there are thousands and thousands of people living in homelessness, you know, living on the streets, that would desperately love to have a job, that would desperately like to live in something other than a cardboard box or a tent, and acting like they somehow have chosen this lifestyle en masse, that in the last 5 years in the Bay Area, they've decided all of a sudden, we just all decided we didn't want to work anymore and we're just going to be homeless now. You know, it's ridiculous. It ignores all the complex social and economic factors that push them into unemployment. So, you know, really these job reports, and that's what I want to point out, are dishonest. One of the most important things we need to look at is wage growth. And what wage growth has done is it has become stagnant. In February, we showed the unemployment rate had dropped significantly and the markets were in turmoil because they were scared, because when there's less unemployed people, you have to start paying your workers more, and investors were nervous about that. But then shortly thereafter, another report came out showing that while it's true unemployment had gone down, wage growth had been stagnant. And then the market shot back up again, because what investors said is, okay, no worries. Sure, the unemployment rate's lower, but we can still really underpay people, so profitability isn't really that threatened. And they're very aware of this. So that stagnating wage is really what's driving this struggle right now, and these unemployment figures are extremely dishonest.
Yeah, the whole thing, I mean, we really need, and I think because definitions, explanations, people understanding the thing is so critically important. That's why I love doing this segment, False Profits, P-R-O-F-I-T-S.
I know you like that title very much.
You know, because there are false prophets who are misleading us. Daniel is... I don't know, Daniel, it's somewhat prophetic what you're doing. That's prophet. But anyway, I like doing it because the way people understand what's going on, the way our ideas form can be based on deception and self-deception. And the two go hand in hand. For instance, if I get up yesterday and I look at the newspaper and the front page is unemployment dips below 4% to 3.9%, it sounds like things are getting better.
Well, especially since most economists will tell you that full employment, or what is considered to be full employment, is 5%, because at any given time, about 5% of the workforce is looking for something better than their in-between jobs. But we know that that's nonsense, that unemployment isn't 3.9%. It can't be 3.9%. This is just, as Daniel pointed out, this is just a number that's, for the most part, just been made up.
Yeah, and in these very strict, narrow categories or definitions of who's employed and who's unemployed, if you're unemployed for a year, you're no longer unemployed. Let's say you worked at a place for, you were making $50,000, $60,000 a year, and your factory or your enterprise closes and goes somewhere else, and you look and look and look for work in your category, and you can't find it, meaning your category, what you're skilled in. And also at the income level that you had been previously getting, and you can't get it. And then you go and you're, let's say, an engineer, and you're not going to necessarily apply at McDonald's. But even if you do, McDonald's might not want you. And so as a consequence, after 6 months or after 8 months, if you stop applying at McDonald's, you're no longer unemployed. And that's just nonsense. The number that we have to look at is that, as Daniel was saying, is the number of people in the labor force compared to the number of people who are not. And that's another category, Daniel. I can't remember the actual name that the Bureau of Labor Statistics gives it, but it's not the number that's quoted. But that number is about 60 people per 100 are in the labor force, meaning adults who could potentially be in the labor force. And that number dropped by about 3 or 4% after the 2008 financial crisis. And it's only now back up to where it was at the beginning of the 2007-2008 recession. That's the real number.
That's the number that really matters. I mean, if you look at, you know, the reports and kind of dig into them, you know, 236,000 people left the labor force in April, which is in part why we're seeing this drop. That's a ton of people. And I think there's a couple other things we want to point out, too. Of course, Republicans and Trump are trumpeting, you know, this tax plan, this huge tax cuts. And they're saying, oh, boy, that there's a clear correlation between these huge tax cuts and these people getting jobs. One of the things that's important to point out is there's $1.5 trillion saved by these corporations. And so far, $390 billion of it, so about 25% more or less, is being pledged to share buybacks, which is basically, it's just giving that money back to the shareholders.
Yeah, like Apple just used the tax windfall they got, I think, to buy $100 million of their own stock. Backs, which raises the stock price of Apple, meaning the investors who hold Apple stock, including of all the bigwigs at Apple, just are, you know, giving themselves personal money.
Yep, they're giving themselves a big raise. Now, share buybacks, talk about the most unproductive use of capital. No one is getting a job from that. No factories are being opened. Nobody's hired. So far, and we're still, you know, we're not halfway through the year yet, about a quarter of it is being used in a way that will not give us a single job. Probably more than that will be announced before the end of the year. We'll have to wait and see. So again, it's this dishonesty that, you know, that somehow there's a correlation between me doing a tax cut and now they're, you know, being this lowered rate. Really, you know, if the idea is that we want to understand the economy, we need to dig into these reports and we need to go beyond them. I'll tell you, Wall Street analysts and these hedge fund managers, they don't read these reports. They dig into the details and the data. They're not looking at the headlines because they know how dishonest they are too. And they know it's just kind of a political stunt for whoever's in office to sound like they're doing big things. So it's really important for us, you know, as working people for whom that unemployment rate, you know, our ability to work and feed our families and have a living wage is fundamental. We need to be smarter about these things and we need to look into them. And when we have a politician smiling and saying, oh, it's below 4%, we need to ask ourselves, what is he really saying? What's really being expressed here?
The unemployment insurance as a function of society, as a function of government, that only happened after 1935 when during the time of the Depression and at the time of a great labor upsurge, the formation of the CIO, the fact that the socialist and communist movement in the United States were very strong and making demands on employers. That's when the government, Roosevelt, agreed to go along with the idea of a Social Security framework so that the elderly would not necessarily die because of immiseration at the time that they could no longer be hired by a boss. And so that the unemployed, who were unemployed as a feature of this particular economic system, in other words, there's a boom-bust cycle, and when the bust part of the cycle happens, people get laid off. They don't get laid off because they've done a bad job. They get laid off en masse because of the nature of, that's one of the functions and features of capitalism. So the government said, look, we're going to give you unemployment insurance, 6 months unemployment insurance. We're going to set up a system whereby employees and employers, while we're working, have to put taxes into this fund, which then becomes the basis for unemployment insurance. But not everyone's entitled to the unemployment insurance. And again, it's for a very limited duration. At the time of the passage of the 1935 unemployment that Social Security framework, agricultural work and domestic work were excluded as categories of workers who were eligible for unemployment insurance. That meant predominantly African-American workers and predominantly female workers who were working in domestic work or working on farms could not be eligible for unemployment insurance. Only later Did that, was that added as a feature? And it's still, you know, it's so tortured in terms of what benefits people have. Let's say there's a mom, let's say you're a single mom, you get laid off from your job. Again, this is not a hypothetical because it's happened to millions of single moms in the last 10 years. And you have a couple of kids at home, and perhaps they're young kids. You don't have money then to pay for childcare. So you stay at home and you try to do the best that you can to just keep those kids going. And again, childcare is around the country extremely expensive. Those moms, after the time of 6 months after they were laid off, they're not eligible for unemployment insurance, but they are doing a socially necessary function, which is providing a child rearing at home. And yet the government says to individual moms or dads who are raising children, and that's obviously a socially necessary labor in society, we're not going to count that as unemployed. And as a consequence, we're not going to give you any benefits. And then if you try to get benefits, you're consigned to the category of being a welfare recipient, which then has a completely different sort of innuendo. And as we know, the very, very rich, mostly white male politicians in Congress are constantly beating up on those workers who are getting welfare as if they are lazy. And I think this is all part, you know, if we abstract the individual or look at individual situations and not look at the big picture of how this particular economic and social system works, it allows all sorts of stereotyping and caricaturing of people to take place. And thus the rich are look like, hey, they're doing well because they're smart and because they're industrious. It has nothing to do with their actual social status in life. So all of these issues are fundamentally at the root, political issues.
Absolutely. I mean, you talk about that unpaid labor, and I think that's a huge part of it. You know, the fact that women have historically, you know, helped to create life and raise children so that society can be stocked and filled with, you know, these laborers that can supposedly help, you know, make America great again. And yet society has never thought to pay them for this, that this is considered totally free labor and considered completely unpaid. I mean, imagine, I don't know how you would even calculate the billions, maybe trillions of dollars that would be involved in that. To say nothing of all the various other types of unpaid labor. You know, I work in the tech industry. Interns are rampant. You are paid zero to work for a company, to write code for it or engage in other administrative tasks or whatever, just for the privilege of saying, oh, I interned at Facebook or something like that. And you're paid zero. And it's considered a totally normal, you know, way of doing things. You know, it's kind of absurd to think that, you know, quotes, employing someone as an intern is and not paying them is real. Or women, you know, raising families in society, an essential part of the continuation of any society, is also unpaid. It's free. So there is a lot when we look at this, you know, economic and social system that we've come to realize that how we organize our labor and how we use our labor is exploitative, is underpaid, is cutting of benefits. And yet our society produces, you know, fantastic amounts of wealth, insane amounts of wealth that we can hardly imagine. And yet, you know, these people, this is all built on this exploitation and all built on this underpayment and all built on this people's inability to get what they've created and get what they're owed. So we need to really think about the larger pictures, look beyond the headlines, look beyond the 3.9% unemployment rate, and ask ourselves, how are we organizing ourselves as an economy? Who is really benefiting here? Who has stability, prosperity, a future, and who doesn't? Because these numbers just become smokescreen and just become a monthly sort of little thing that pops out that politicians can pat themselves on the backs about.
Daniel, I'd like to switch subjects here for a minute and talk about oil prices. So oil prices per barrel, the international standard, not the U.S. Brent crude, but the international price closed yesterday above $70 a barrel for the first time since 2014. So this is in light of the fact that the U.S. is withdrawing from the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, and is also trying hard to rattle the Venezuelan economy, which is an oil-based economy. So should we be getting used to high gas prices now and high oil prices, or do you see shale making a comeback and fracking? Because fracking isn't profitable unless oil prices are above $60 a barrel.
Yeah, we're going to see a couple of things. So with this cut in oil production, which was orchestrated by some of the largest oil producers, so mostly Russia and Saudi Arabia, they decided to cut back because Saudi had kind of gone rogue for the last few years and really massively increased supply. The intent was to depress price and to push down the oil market to outcompete other countries that were trying to produce oil desperately to feed their societies, and also to wipe out fracking, which was seen as kind of an existential threat to Saudi. Now that seems to have done its work. The fracking industry has gone belly up in a lot of ways and isn't profitable. And so they're starting to cut back and scale back. So yes, we'll see fracking come into play because now it's becoming profitable again. So there will be investors that are willing to do it and dump in their money. But this is also a sign that, you know, Saudi can't go with these, you know, very low oil prices for much longer, that their economy is heavily dependent on it, and that they're not able to continue to kind of overproduce like this. I think that we are going to continue to see oil prices, especially with the pullout of the JCPOA. So we're having big producers cutting prices or cutting production, and then we're having Iran's oil supply being pushed out of the market due to new sanctions. So this will continue to increase. But, you know, it's how this kind of cyclical market movement works, because then fracking will kick in because it becomes profitable. It will do as much as it can to profit as quickly as possible, which will then once again flood the oil markets, which will once again depress prices. So really what's contingent a lot on this is fracking production. I think we will see a boom in fracking. I think we will see high oil prices in the near to medium term. But I think in the long term, fracking will kind of take its pound of flesh, and it will cause prices to start going back down again as the market is flooded.
What does that mean for employment in places like North Dakota, for example, or Oklahoma, where fracking created so many jobs and drove housing prices sky high and then crashed down just as quickly as they had risen? Are we going to see that kind of boom and bust cycle again in some of these states where fracking is so heavily done?
Yeah, absolutely. We're definitely going to. I mean, whether it's Saudi or Russia or one of these other major oil companies, you know, if fracking really takes off and the oil price stays really high, they see the writing on the wall. They know that the shift is going to be towards fracking and away from the style of oil production that they have. Also, the current administration is extremely friendly to domestic oil producers and wants to do as much as possible to move regulation around and incentivize them to produce here. This is kind of part of that nationalist America First policy. They want to see us making our own oil and, you know, to heck with these other companies. So yeah, we'll see that boom and bust. Fracking will explode, it'll blow up, but the OPEC countries like Saudi are not just going to stand idly by. They're very smart, they're very well informed, and they will fight to push it back down again once they've created enough profitability. You know, incidentally, we talk about Saudi, and there's this huge push now for them to privatize their nationalized oil company, Aramco, to essentially sell it on the open market and allow investors to invest in it. This is part of Saudi Arabia trying to move away from oil dependence and trying to create revenue streams other than oil. But that's a long-term project. That's not going to happen overnight. You know, if it does happen, it'll be the largest initial public offering in history. So I think we will see that boom and bust cycle. For working people, it means higher prices at the pump. It also means commodities will be more expensive because oil will cost more, and oil is needed to produce nearly everything we use, everything we consume, whether it's trucks to get the products there or fueling the factories which produce the products we need. So overall, for working people, it will mean higher prices basically just about everywhere. The ones who will really benefit, of course, are the oil producers who are looking to make a killing as there's this sudden ramp up in price.
And after the depression of oil prices and a lot of the fracking operations went out of business, as John mentioned, and workers who had come to these towns and made these towns, these became boom towns with rising real estate prices, then they all collapsed. Some of the companies that hadn't collapsed, including some of the Saudi oil money, then went into and purchased a substantial number of U.S. oil operations in anticipation of the increase again at some future time of rising oil prices, thus making it profitable once again. There's one other factor, though, in oil prices, which is demand is one part of it. Supply is one part of it, but the other part is demand. And we've had 10 years of economic expansion after the recession. Again, we talked earlier about how it wasn't evenly distributed. Nonetheless, it was a big economic expansion. That means a bigger, higher demand for oil. But the next economic recession has to be around the corner. It's been 10 or 11 years now.
Oh, yeah, we're due. Overdue, maybe.
So with a big recession, that means a contraction in the demand for oil, and that could be huge. I mean, of course, obviously it would be huge. Daniel, 45 seconds left. You get the final word.
Yeah, we're definitely going to see a continuation of the boom-bust cycle. Certainly, that's how it's gone for the last 100 years of capitalist development. And ultimately, at the end of the day, whether it's booming or busting, it's going to be working people that will have to bear the brunt of it. It won't be oil executives. It will be them that will have to pay at the pump and elsewhere.
I think that's the kind, most economists are usually wrong, at least in some of their predictions. But I think Daniel's completely right about that prediction.
Yeah, I think he's right as well. I agree.
The ultra rich will do all right.
Yeah, they're going to be just fine.
Yep. All right. We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined again, as we are every Tuesday, by Daniel Sankey in our segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.